user of the MIT computer network. He didn't hack into anything. He logged in as any guest on the MIT campus could. He certainly downloaded more of JSTOR than they wanted, but it wasn't to steal anything. These are a bunch of old academic journals that exist now for the purposes of increasing people's knowledge. The idea to call Aaron a thief is just pandering to the lowest instincts of people, of viewers or listeners of Carmen Ortiz's press conference.
We just played Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney in Boston, who Steve Hyman worked for.
Correct.
We just played a clip of Aaron talking about his philosophy and, you know, talking about JSTOR and being concerned about the disparity of resources, intellectual resources, for people, say, in India or versus in the United States. Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a huge concern of his, this walling up of the world's information behind a paywall.
You are one of the people involved in the February 11th action that will be taking place. Explain what it is.
Well, we're leading up to some actions. You know, it's part of a group called Stop Watching Us that was formed to protest NSA overreach and, you know, this kind of surveillance state that's been revealed to us by Edward Snowden. And so
amazing to listen to him a year before Edward Snowden talk about NSA surveillance.
Well, we found that clip of Aaron. It was chilling, actually. We found Aaron talking quite a bit about NSA overreach, the amount of searching that they were doing, the amount of people that they were surveilling at that point. And those clips come about a year and a week or so before the main Snowden revelations. And he even says in the clip, there's never been a moment when we really mobilize that really sparks action. And he just didn't live to see that moment.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us and for your film, Brian Knappenberger. The film is called, his first film, We Are Legion, the story of the hacktivists, but this film is called The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz and Elliot Peters, Aaron's attorney. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nafel, Sarah Martin, Emmerich, Shake, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, and to the whole crew here at Park City TV in Park City, Utah. I'm Amy Goodman at the Sundance Film Festival.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:05. Up next is the KBOO Evening News, right after these messages.
Now is the time to act the fool tonight. Forget about your worries and you will be all right.
Oaks Park Roller Rink and KBOO Community Radio proudly present Bounce, Roll, Skate. Tuesday, January 28th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Oaks Park Roller Rink. They'll be broadcasting a two-hour funk and disco special live from KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, and you can be a part of it. It's a theme party, so feel free to wear your favorite 70s outfits, wigs, and costumes, or wear whatever you like. That's Bounce, Roll, Skate, January 28th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Oaks Park Roller Rink. Call 503-231-8032 or go to kbu.fm/themeltingpot for more information.
Mo is Shy, the KBOO docudrama based on the Portland Christmas tree trial, airs this January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. Here's FBI undercover agent Hussein by Ross Freeman Levin.
We started with small talk. It was important to get him to like me so we could get all the facts. Then the defendant came up with the target of Pioneer Square. He came up with the idea to get a truck full of explosives and blow people up at the tree lighting ceremony on November 26th.
January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Depending on who you listen to.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Signatures delivered to the city of Portland for a chance to vote on public water.
White House pushes fast-track bill.
A reflection on Martin Luther King Day of service around the state. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 21st, 2014. I'm Nat Parker.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. 50,000 signatures on a petition to create a new water authority was delivered to the city of Portland this morning. Voters will have the chance to decide in May if the proposal is in their best interest or not, if at least 30,000 of them are valid. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Depending on who you listen to, the issue is either removing the ability of the city of Portland to spend unnecessarily or preventing a private and unaccountable group from controlling a premier water and sewage facility.
You know, our reasons for supporting a public water district for Portland are the same as, you know, most ratepayers, in that we're just fed up with the continued mismanagement of Portland's water system.
Ken Crayford is the co-chief petitioner of the Portland Public Water Initiative. Mr. Crayford represents Portlanders for Water Reform.
The diversion of water and sewer funds away from core infrastructure towards City Hall PEP projects, the revolving door of crony managers between City Hall staffers and six-figure jobs at the Water Bureau in particular. So we just think it's time for reform.
Portland Commissioner Nick Fish doesn't, for what he considers some pretty compelling reasons.
A corporate-backed initiative led by Kent Crayford and John DiLorenzo, two high-powered corporate lobbyists, today delivered 50,000 signatures to the auditor's office. The initiative is funded by a bottling company, a German wafer company, and two property management companies. And their idea is that we should take the Water Bureau and the Bureau of Environmental Services away from the city and create a water district with seven volunteer board members managing both systems and essentially transfer $20 billion of public infrastructure to this board.
Another organization that is part of the effort to wrest control of the Water and Sewer Authority from the City of Portland is Friends of the Reservoirs. Floy Jones is their spokesperson.
For the last 12 years, we have been working on every issue of concern related to the water system and BES, and we found City Council non-responsive to the interests of the community. We've seen water rates rise 160% since 2000. We've seen spending on projects that have absolutely nothing to do with the services of the bureaus. It's modeled on the Eugene Water and Electric Board. It's modeled after that.
But for Commissioner Fish, another model came to mind.
It's called the Clackamas River Water District. And if you Google that, you'll see that it's been called one of the most dysfunctional local governments in Oregon. And that's their model.
Another aspect of this story is the money. Portlanders for Water Reform and Friends of the Reservoirs complain that the city has for years ignored the concerns of ratepayers and gone back on some of their own promises.
Earlier this year, Mayor Hales came into office. He'd campaigned on being a reformer. He'd campaigned on actually lowering water and sewer rates. And one of the first things he did was pass a major water and sewer rate increase.
But besides concerns of big local money and foreign money supporting the initiative, Commissioner Fish and the city have heard from environmental groups that are opposed to the initiative. However, the city recognizes that its fight over the control of the water and sewer facilities aren't just about control. They're also about reputation, and Commissioner Fish recognizes that the city has some work to do in that area.
We're taking concrete steps to strengthen trust with our ratepayers.
These efforts have been to strengthen trust. Is that to say that you saw a need to strengthen trust?
Sure. I think coming in, there was a need to frankly get back to our core mission and to demonstrate that we could be disciplined with ratepayer dollars, and we've done so.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Commissioner Fish says people who want to see the proposal submitted by Friends of the Reservoirs and Portlanders for Water Reform can visit the auditor's website or Google Portland Water Reform Measure.
The state of West Virginia has lifted a ban on consuming tap water over a week after a chemical spill contaminated the water supply there. Freedom Industries spilled substances used in the coal cleaning process just upstream from the West Virginia American Water Plant's intake. Among the substances spilled was a chemical known as crude MCHM. When West Virginia's Department of Environmental Protection arrived on the scene shortly after the spill on January 9th, they found that the company responsible for the spill had taken no spill containment measures. The health department in West Virginia reports that over 400 people have reported symptoms related to the spill, and about 20 have been admitted to hospitals for symptoms patients say are related to the spill. In response to the contamination, the state issued a ban on consuming tap water. The state lifted that ban on Saturday, saying that chemical levels had reached safe levels. However, the CDC has recommended that pregnant women drink only bottled water until the levels of contamination fall to be undetectable. Moreover, healthcare experts recommend that small children and schools only consume bottled water. In a press conference on Monday, West Virginia Governor Tomblin told residents that it is their decision on whether they feel comfortable drinking the tap water, but he would not say it was 100% safe. Freedom Industries has been cited for air and water quality violations already. The company, meanwhile, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This type of bankruptcy allows a company to keep operating while a bankruptcy judge sorts out which creditors are to be paid first. The owner of Freedom Industries, J. Clifford Forrest, has started a new company called Mountaineer Funding.
The Oregon legislature will get to take another look at the debate to label genetically modified foods again next month. Voters could get a chance to decide this issue at the polls in November. A new bill will be introduced by Representative Paul Holvey that would refer the issue of labeling GMO foods to voters. Last year, Washington barely rejected a GMO labeling initiative, and the year before, California also rejected a similar initiative. In the Oregon legislature's fall special session, lawmakers passed a law that bans local governments from regulating genetically modified plants. After that, Governor John Kitzhaber promised a task force that would be convened to consider issues like labeling requirements and the prevention of organic agriculture becoming contaminated. New efforts are now making that process unnecessary. Scott Bates from Tigard said is the lead behind two initiatives that would require GMO labeling on foods. The first initiative was approved in December to start collecting signatures, and the second is awaiting a ballot title. Bates is willing to drop his initiative to support Holvey's if it passes. Getting to the Senate will be difficult even if the bill passes in the House. Last year, legislation regarding the requirements of genetically modified foods, agriculture, and labeling failed to advance from the committee.
Environmental activists in Corvallis are trying to clean the water in Sequoia Creek using burlap bags filled with straw and coffee grounds that will grow mushrooms inside. According to the group Ocean Blue Project, yellow oyster mushroom spawn will be placed inside the burlap bags filled with coffee grounds and straw. These bags will be placed in locations where water entering storm drains will filter through the bags. The underground part of the mushroom, known as the mycelium, has the ability to break down toxins in oil and pesticides. The mycelium also has the ability to metabolize the harmful E. coli bacteria. Richard Arterbury, president of the Ocean Blue Project, is excited about the prospect of using biological processes to reduce pollution in waterways. Similar techniques have been used successfully in the Puget Sound, where mushrooms have removed E. coli from the waters. Volunteers with the Ocean Blue Project placed their first bag in a drainage culvert on Sunday. It has been suggested that other food wastes, such as wastes from local breweries, could also be used for growing the mushrooms inside of the burlap bags. The city of Corvallis is very enthusiastic and supportive of this project. The bags will post a sign warning against eating the mushrooms that are growing in the bags, though the yellow oyster spawn is edible. If the project with Sequoia Creek is successful, volunteers plan to expand the project along other areas of the Willamette River.
There will be a solidarity event held tomorrow concerning the opening of the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. This will be a non-arrestable, completely nonviolent, free speech public assembly sidewalk event. Those interested in attending will assemble outside the TransCanada offices in the Umpqua Plaza block on the east side of the block of the NATO Parkway sidewalk between Southwest Columbia and Southwest Jefferson. There will be an outdoors public assembly demonstrating solidarity with the residents, tribal members, workers, landowners, farmers, ranchers, and tar sands blockaders who have boldly resisted the construction of the southern leg of the KXL, also known as the Gulf Coast Pipeline.
The beautiful monarch butterfly is in danger of disappearing. Last year, there were 59% fewer monarch butterflies in Mexico. This is the lowest number of monarchs in over 20 years. Experts predict that the numbers this year will be even lower. Laura Tangley with the National Wildlife Federation says that the cause is a combination of the loss of habitat and climate change. The monarchs depend on the milkweed plant, which is disappearing due to the increased use of corn for biofuels. Milkweed used to grow between the rows of corn, but now the herbicide-tolerant, genetically modified corn is heavily sprayed with Roundup, leaving the corn but killing the milkweed. Roundup drifts to other areas, killing all but the genetically modified plants. Climate change also affects the migratory habits of the monarchs. Under normal conditions, when the weather turns cold, the monarchs head south to Mexico to lay their eggs. When the weather does not turn cold, the monarchs mistakenly fly north and then die. For researchers watching butterflies, the outlook for monarchs is not good.
A new report released today found that the wealth of the 85 richest people in the world is 65 times the wealth of the 3 billion people at the bottom half of the economic ladder. The report, titled Working for the Few, was released by Oxfam, an international group working to alleviate poverty. It highlights the potential impacts of wealth concentrations on social and political environments, such as the erosion of democratic governance, the pulling apart of social cohesion, and the vanishing of equal opportunities for all. Oxfam is concerned that if wealth concentrations remain unchecked, the effect would be irreversible and lead opportunity capture, in which the lowest tax rates, the best education, and the best health care are claimed by the children of the rich. The United States has the worst trend in wealth concentration and apparently are aware of it. According to a Gallup poll, 67% of Americans are dissatisfied with income and wealth distribution.
The southeast area of Portland has seen the largest number of single-family home demolitions in the last year. According to City of Portland records, single-family home demolition permits are up 40% over last year, with more than 230 demolition to the demolition permits. The city issued over 2,700 permits for alterations and additions, which can mean the demolition of the majority of the home, as long as even a tiny portion of a wall or floor are left. Neighbors are upset in some cases. Many would like some form of advance warning so they can cover plants, move cars, or watch for environmental issues. Also, many neighbors feel that the system favors developers over residents. With a normal demolition permit, there is a 35-day waiting period, during which time neighbors in the neighborhood association is given advanced notice and large orange signs are posted. However, two exceptions allow builders and developers to avoid notifying surrounding property owners and neighborhood associations. If a property owner applies for and pays for a building permit at the same time as a demolition permit, no advance notice is required. The second way around neighborhood notification is for the property owner to apply for an alteration or demolition permit. As long as the builder leaves even the tiniest portion of the original building, they can qualify for this type of permit. Some developers say that the required posting of a large orange sign alerts thieves that the house is unoccupied and makes the house a target, and that is why they apply for a waiver. City of Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz, who manages the Development Bureau, says that she does not feel an advance warning is needed.
Gunshots were heard today in Portland at the corner of Southeast 82nd and Foster Road at around 11:15 a.m. Police have scant evidence on the suspects, but believe the barrage may have followed a dispute between two men. A Shell gas station, Automotive Outfitters, and Taco Time all sustained damage due to the gunfire. No injuries were reported.
Yesterday was the federal holiday to commemorate the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but it is also a National Day of Service. And Oregonians are all about service. A national report says 1 in 3 spends time volunteering. For more on this story, KBOO's volunteer Genevieve McDaniel worked in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
For many Oregonians, Martin Luther King Jr. Day is more than a federal holiday. It's a day to honor Dr. King's legacy by volunteering. Yesterday, almost 200 people signed up for 3 big one-day projects in Central Oregon. They're cleaning or painting at community centers in Bend and Lapine and a food bank in Redmond. Katya Speaker with Volunteer Connect says her group matches volunteers with more than 120 partner organizations, and often a one-day commitment turns into a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. In fact, I don't know many volunteers that haven't felt that when they have given their time to an effort and then be able to see, you know, what they've contributed to, see the impact that they have made.
A new national report says Oregon ranks 11th in the country for volunteerism. About one-third of Oregonians spend an average of 52 hours a year as volunteers, which equates to more than $3 billion worth of service hours. One of them is Eric Lindstrom of Portland. 3 years ago, he found himself in John Day Basin, helping pull old barbed wire fences off of public land. He went at the suggestion of a friend and says it was quite a workout that started a longer-term commitment.
On the way out of there, I stopped and I turned around and looked, and I could not believe how different that country looked just by pulling those 3 strands and those red posts out of the ground. And that just transformed my whole thinking about service activity, and it was just a wonderful experience.
Lindstrom, who is retired, has also used his writing and photography skills to help some groups. He predicts as baby boomers hit retirement age, they will discover that volunteering is a great way to stay active and be part of the community.
I think we're headed towards a golden age of service contributions and service learning, especially for the older populations. You know, you always think about service learning for kids in school, but service learning is actually a great adult education activity.
So Lindstrom says he now thinks of volunteering not only in terms of what he can give, but what he can learn from it. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Students at University of Michigan are pressuring the administration to meet 7 demands addressing the lack of diversity and inclusion at the college. The Black Student Union, BSU, stood at the steps of the Hill Auditorium at the university Monday after a speech was given as part of Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Service by civil rights activist and entertainer Harry Belafonte, demanding that the administrators improve the quality of life on campus. The BSU students at the University of Michigan are expecting the administration of the university to meet the list of demands within 7 days, or the BSU students plan to take physical action.
To the faculty and staff and the entire University of Michigan community, both alums and students alike, this is what inspires us. Michigan is a place that creates the leaders and best to teach every academic discipline to create the imaginable leaders that come from the White House to the Peace Corps to even teach for America. The legacy of Michigan is the very audacity to be ambitious and to fight for the social justice on this campus. And this is what inspires our movement.
We demand that the university give us an equal opportunity to implement change. The change that complete restoration of the BSU purchasing power through an increased budget can obtain. 2, we demand that the university give us available housing on Central Campus for those of lower socioeconomic status at a rate which students can afford to be a part of the university life and not just the periphery. 3, we demand an opportunity to congregate and to share our experiences in a new trotter and located on Central Campus. 4, we demand an opportunity to be educated and to educate about the America's historical treatment and marginalization of colored groups. through race and ethnicity requirements throughout all schools and colleges within the university. 5, we demand an equal opportunity to succeed with emergency scholarships for black students in need of financial support, with the mental anxiety of not being able to focus on and afford university academic lifestyle. 6, we demand for an increased disclosure of all documents within the Bentley Library. There should be transparency about the university.
The BSU students gained momentum in the fall after the Twitter hashtag BBUM trended nationally. The University of Michigan administration has responded to the efforts, helping to sponsor forums for increased dialogue on issues of race on campus.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned tonight for an interview with KBOO's Robin Ryan as she speaks about recent oil spills with David Turnbull of Oil Change International after this newscast, followed by at 6 by Out Loud. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Dana for the 2014 Meaningful Care Conference to talk about the aim to promote LGBTQ cultural competency in healthcare and social services. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock will highlight poetry and work by Amiri Baraka and Danny Glover. Tomorrow's weather is a slight chance of rain with a high of 50 degrees and a night low of 33 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are counts per minute in Powell Butte measures 27 cpm. Seaside, Oregon has 32 cpm with a high of 62. Hanford, Washington has 28 cpm, high of 50. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 33 counts per minute with spikes up to 58. EPA alert levels start at 100 cpm. And more information can be found online at radcast.org.
It's 5:30. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In the movie plot of a spy thriller, our hero gets captured by agents of a repressive government, and they take him into a dark interrogation room where the sadistic spy master hisses at him, "We have ways of making you talk." Meanwhile, in real life, the director of our national security agency hisses at journalists, "We have ways of keeping you from talking." Well, not quite in those words, but General Keith Alexander, chief spook at NSA and head of U.S. Cyber Command, did reveal a chilling disrespect for our constitutional right to both free speech and a free press. In an October interview, he called for outlawing any reporting on his agency's secret program of spying on every American. "I think it's wrong that newspaper reporters have all these documents, giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make any sense." Then came his spooky punchline. "We ought to come up with a way of stopping it. It's wrong to allow this to go on." Holy Thomas Paine! Spy on us, okay? Report on it, not. What country does this autocrat represent? Alexander's secret, indiscriminate supercomputer scooping up of data on every phone call, email, and other private business of every American is what doesn't make any sense. It's an Orwellian mass invasion of everyone's privacy, creating the kind of routine 24/7 surveillance state our government loudly deplores in China and Russia. And it amounts to stomping on our Fourth Amendment guarantee that we're to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. This is Jim Hightower saying that's the real outrage we should be stopping. But no, our constitutionally clueless spymaster doubles down on his dangerous ignorance by also stomping on the First Amendment. If this was a movie, people would laugh at it as being too far-fetched to believe. But there it is, horribly real.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A bill introduced last week will give President Obama fast-track authority to negotiate trade pacts with little to no legislative dispute. The Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priorities Act of 2014 was introduced to the Senate on the 7th of this month by Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus, along with Ranking Member Orrin Hatch. A companion bill, was simultaneously introduced to Congress by House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Dave Camp, Republican from Mississippi. The Hill reports that the White House is making a concerted effort to have the bill approved by Congress, which would give President Obama trade promotion authority and the ability to quickly approve the heavily debated Trans-Pacific Partnership. The campaign that fast-track means trade bills that come before Congress will have limited debate, will have to be voted on in a short period, and can't be amended or filibustered. There's been no co-sponsorship for the bill by House Democrats, and the bill will no longer be bipartisan once Democratic Senator Finance Committee Chairman Baucus to China.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Local Teamsters Union officials are taking a look at details of a restructuring agreement the union says will save more than 30,000 good American jobs. The Teamsters reached a tentative agreement with YRC Worldwide that, quote, provides a pathway for substantial debt reduction and refinancing initiatives, end quote, that the Teamsters say will permit the company to protect and preserve the jobs. An initial company offer was rejected January 9th in a vote by over 19,000 Teamsters members. If the Committee of Local Teamsters officials approve, the tentative agreement will be sent on then to the membership for a ratification vote. Teamsters President Jim Hoffa says the union pushed to re-engage all stakeholders in YRC Worldwide to come up with an alternative solution that protects jobs. Wisconsin is marking the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United U.S. Supreme Court decision with a rally and press conference calling on the Wisconsin legislature to debate a resolution that would put the Citizens United question to the voters of Wisconsin in a statewide referendum. A Wisconsin coalition is backing the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They want Wisconsin to join 16 other states and over 500 communities nationwide that are calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the decision that allows corporations unlimited spending in elections. Congressional Republicans continue to hold jobless Americans hostage to other demands they're making before they will agree to extend unemployment benefits, and the suffering of people who have been unemployed for a long time continues. Workers recently delivered petitions to GOP congressional leaders in Washington urging that the benefits be extended. On a recent press conference call organized by Americans United for Change, Candace Hemmerly, a Wisconsin worker unemployed for more than 6 months, tearfully called on Congress to extend the benefits.
I've depleted my retirement to keep my son in college. I have not had the courage to tell him that I'm out of work. I began collecting, I'm so sorry. I began collecting my unemployment once a week. I received each week, but I made it barely. I implore Congress to renew the federal unemployment insurance just to keep a roof over my head.
Alaska Airlines flight attendants are voting until February 14th on a new contract. The Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, says the new proposed deal includes top-of-the-industry improvements in many categories. 3,100 Alaska Airlines flight attendants are eligible to vote on the proposed new contract. The tentative agreement was reached between the union and Alaska Airlines with the help of the National Mediation Board.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A state of emergency has been declared in Thailand's capital of Bangkok and surrounding areas to prevent an increase in the amount of violence during the anti-government protests. The decree takes effect Wednesday and will last 60 days. It will expand the power of security forces, letting them issue curfews and censor media. They will also be able to search protesters, ban political gatherings of more than 5 people, and arrest and detain protesters without charges. The anti-government protesters are preventing Prime Minister Yingluck access to her office in the government house. The 3-month-long protest is an effort to get the prime minister to step down. Lately, increases in violence, including grenades being thrown into protest groups, have been occurring. On Sunday, 28 people were injured by 2 grenades thrown into one of the many protest sites around the city. The government and anti-government protesters blame each other for the increase in violence.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org for Tuesday, January 21st, 2014. Israeli troops injured a Palestinian teenager during clashes in the West Bank and settlers attack villagers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian teenager was injured on Tuesday afternoon during clashes between local youth and invading Israeli troops at Aid refugee camp in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. Local sources said that the boy was hit in the head and was moved to a nearby hospital for treatment, where his conditions were described as moderate. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation that was fired by Israeli soldiers. Earlier on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers invaded various districts in occupied West Bank, broke into dozens of homes, searched them, and kidnapped several Palestinians. Local sources in Bethlehem have reported that dozens of soldiers invaded Beit Fajar and Ubadiyya nearby towns and kidnapped 2 civilians. Troops also invaded Ramuna village west of the northern West Bank city of Jenin and kidnapped 3 Palestinians after searching their homes. Later in the day, Israeli forces and settlers prevented 2 Palestinian farmers from Hussan, west of Bethlehem, from accessing their farmland located in the middle of the illegal settlement of Bitar Elite, said local officials. Member of Hussan Village Council, Mohammed Shosha, said that 2 farmers wanted to plant olive seedlings in their land when soldiers and settlers prevented them from entering it. Shosha said that Israeli forces first told the farmers that they must get an army permit to enter their land, but then told them they could enter but without the siblings. He added that soldiers attacked Mohammed Ilayan, a photojournalist with Al-Quds newspaper, when he tried to take pictures of the incident. In related news, Israeli settlers vandalized on Tuesday 8 Palestinian-owned cars in the town of Kabalan, south of Nablus in northern West Bank. Local sources said that the settlers attacked the outskirts of the town, smashing the windows of 8 cars and slashing their tires. Settlers also sprayed racist graffiti on walls of several Palestinian homes, the sources added. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was on the 14th. News roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a group of 57 mine clearance workers were released on Tuesday after being captured by unknown gunmen. The Afghani men were released after being abducted in an Afghanistan province. The men captured were employees of Halo Trust, a mining nonprofit which removes hazardous mines left over from wars. As Afghan President Hamid Karzai prepares to step down this 2014 election as president and the withdrawal of NATO troops, concerns of the election's process may be disrupted by anti-government insurgents. Security officials, along with NATO officials, met in Kabul, Afghanistan over the weekend to discuss assurance over security for voter turnout. The U.S. is still pressuring Karzai to sign the bilateral security agreement, which he is still resisting and is not willing to sign an agreement until the U.S. meets the demands before signing the security agreement.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sun Rose, Robin Ryan, Stephen Sherritt, Genevieve McDaniel, and Don Merrill. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Nat Parker. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, on Political Perspectives, it's The Prospects of War in 2014. Professor Francis Boyle is interviewed by Jeff Blankfort. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter interviews climate change communication strategist Anna Fahey about how to bring the crucial issue of global warming into the conversation. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you would like to become a member, please go to kboo.fm on the internet and click on Donate Today. And after our program tonight, please stay tuned for an interview conducted by KBOO's Robin Ryan as she speaks about recent oil spills with David Turnbull of Oil Change International, directly following this newscast. Good night, Rosalyn.
Good night, Nat.
Of the information available at Dirty Energy Money reveals over $3 million has found its way to campaign coffers of the current members of Congress. The three leading oil industry contributions that have been made come from Koch Industries at $7.3 million, ExxonMobil at $6.8 million, and Chevron, who donated nearly $4 million. I'm talking with David Turnbull. He is the campaigns director at Oil Change International.
Thanks for having me on.
According to data released by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, over 1 million gallons of oil was spilled from rail cars in 2013. This represents more than the total spilled from this form of transportation for oil from 1975 to 2012. Have you any theories that explain such a drastic jump in the number of incidents and the amount of oil spilled in the United States?
The oil industry in the U.S. is sort of being let loose a bit, and we're seeing a boom in production that's really threatening our climate and our communities. So we're seeing the U.S. public standing up and saying, we don't want to see new pipelines built. We don't want to see these trains going through our backyards. But the oil industry still is trying to get this oil to market. So they're seeing an increase in the use of oil by rail. And with that increase in oil being transported by rail, we're seeing a big jump in spills and problems with that. We've seen some really, really devastating results, such as what we saw in Lac Mégantic in Canada, with a town just simply being devastated by an explosion. And we see spills almost on a daily basis, it seems, because of the massive increase in oil by rail being trained all around the country.
Wasn't there a time when oil was transported primarily through pipelines? Is that infrastructure less desirable in the eyes of industry now?
I think the industry is looking to do whatever they can to get their dirty oil to market. We're seeing the Keystone XL pipeline and other pipelines being stood up against by citizens who don't want these dirty pipelines in their backyards. So they're looking for these other means like rail. And they're also developing new technologies that can allow them to get their oil onto the rail cars more quickly. But what we are seeing is technology to keep oil safe in those cars. A lot of the rail cars that are being used are these really old .111 rail cars that are simply unsafe, and they're extremely old and are a real problem when it comes to community safety around these trains. So the industry is just really going gung-ho to exploit and extract as much oil as possible while they ignore the calls of climate scientists who say we need to keep oil in the ground. And they ignore the people that they're disrupting with train spills and extraction and air pollution.
Do you believe the risks pose a greater threat than the potential for benefit in a commercial sense?
Absolutely. We are being told by those energy analysts that we already have too much oil in our proven reserves. Oil by rail enables oil companies to continue pumping up as much oil as they can possibly pump up. And this is really just ignoring the facts of climate change. And then if you look on the local level, we know that tanker traffic, train traffic is really disruptive to communities, both because of these outrageous and really problematic spills and explosions even, but also because of the pollution and other impacts that increased train activity has in communities. So it's without a doubt the wrong way for our energy policy to be moving and our energy infrastructure to be moving. We need to be moving away from oil, and we need to be moving more towards cleaner energy that really can take heed of this climate science that we're being met with and actually move us in a cleaner direction.
Can you talk about the costs associated with the spills? How much time do you see as having to pass before the depth and the diversity of damage can actually be assessed?
I would like to think that we already have that information now. We know that addressing climate change is going to be far cheaper in the short term than in the long term. And these rail cars that are filled with oil are simply continuing us on the path of fossil fuel dependence, oil dependence, and climate disruption. So there are specific costs associated with building the infrastructure to allow oil to be transported by rail. But the fact of the matter is that we actually don't even need to get to that step to understand the true cost of moving all of this oil in this way. We already know that we have far too much oil than we can afford to burn. And we also know that there are solutions out there, whether it's electric vehicles, a better public transportation, more livable cities. We know that we can move away from oil. And so the cost that are associated with changing our infrastructure to carry oil by train is just simply irrational, and we need to be moving in a totally different direction.
Oh, I was trying to get a feel for what this is. And then with the environmental concerns, there's aspects of it that you won't be able to measure for some time to come.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we've seen this with pipeline spills, and we're seeing it now more and more with train derailments as well. the impacts of oil spills on communities are devastating. In Kalamazoo and Michigan, we've seen that, you know, multiple years after a tar sands oil spill up there, they're still dealing with getting the oil out of their river and out of their communities. In Arkansas, just last year, there was a major oil spill there. That was a pipeline spill as well. But the impacts of oil spills on communities are really, really devastating. Lac-Mégantic in Canada is going to be a changed town for many years to come because of the massive explosion that we saw there. It's hard to fathom. And I think that that community and many communities that are dealing with train derailments and explosions, et cetera, are going to be dealing with these issues for many years to come. It's a really sad reality right now.
So I'm correct. There's really no way to assess the cost at the front end.
I think that's right.
Your organization sent a representative to the climate change conference in Warsaw late last year. I'd like you to talk for a minute about what principles you feel are guiding policy on a global level.
Sure. The global level has a lot of parallels to what we see in the U.S. We see countries that have contributed the least to causing climate change, like developing countries in Africa and Southeast Asia and Pacific Island states, who are really already grappling with massive today. And they're calling out desperately. We saw a really impressive call from the Philippine negotiator as his country was dealing with the devastating impacts of a super typhoon there. They're calling for more urgent and more ambitious action on climate change. And what we're seeing is that some of the countries that are most responsible for the issues and have the most capacity, rich developed countries around the world, simply aren't really up to the task, it seems, so far. Their commitments are not as strong as they need to be to address the science of climate change adequately. So that's a pretty dire picture, but I think in the next couple of years, hopefully we can see a change in course. We have a major negotiation summit in Paris in 2015 that is supposed to be the setting for a new agreement on addressing climate change at the global level. And we have at the middle of this year, actually in September, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, will be hosting a summit in New York on the sidelines of the General Assembly with world leaders, where he'll be helping to push them to make stronger commitments on climate change. So we're going to be following it pretty closely, trying to push governments to end things like fossil fuel subsidies that are helping to incentivize the use of fossil fuels rather than new renewable technologies. And we're going to be helping to sort of push governments to have more ambition and really understand the stakes involved in these negotiations and the need to address climate change more seriously.
Do you think the conversations are being had as global leaders of publics or folks who are really reflective of the will of industry?
It's hard to say. One of the challenges that we saw in Warsaw was the role of, in particular, the coal industry in Poland. Many people were calling Poland coal-land, reflective of the amount of influence that that coal industry has on the government's policies. So the fossil fuel industry is trying as hard as they can to keep the status quo and see their fuel continue to be used as we move forward. And they really do exert a lot of influence, both at the national level by influencing national capitals around the world, including Washington, D.C., of course, but also at the international level by greenwashing different non-solutions to climate change and talking about and all of these things that we know just simply isn't true and won't be the case and not a part of a sustainable future. So, you know, we have a major effort to really combat those industry influences on our side on this. And the public does want and demand climate action as quickly as possible. So it's about raising those voices up and making sure that they're heard by the political leaders and they know that their citizens are behind them and taking strong action on climate change. We need to make as much noise as possible, I think, because, you know, the only thing that beats the money of industry is voices of the people.
For folks finding they'd like to know more about cleaner and safer forms of energy, what websites would you recommend?
Well, our website is www.priceofoil.org. And there you can find more information on some of the challenges of fossil fuels, et cetera. there's some great websites out there as well that are talking about solutions. Climate Progress is a great blog that really highlights a lot of the different things going on. Climate Solutions in the Pacific Northwest is a fantastic organization that's really putting forward a lot of great renewable sources of energy and policies. So I think there's a lot out there. Of course, there's always good things on the blog there that's highlighting all the great new initiatives and things like that. And then there's groups like Solar Mosaic or Sungevity and other solar companies that are doing some really innovative stuff to make sure that solar can be affordable for citizens who want it. You know, I mean, I think one of the biggest things that underlies a lot of this with respect to industry influence is just the massive amount of money that the industry in the U.S., the fossil fuel industry, inserts into politics. We have a website called dirtyenergymoney.com that looks at the amount of money that fossil fuel interests spend on campaign contributions to members of Congress and also now at the state level as well. And it's really, really shocking how much money they put into distorting our democracy. And so when we're talking about solutions to the climate crisis, one big part of that is going to need to be solving the way that our politics structured and dealing with campaign finance reform and other things that really put the industry at an advantage over citizens and the public and the way they're listening to money instead of people. So we do a lot of work, and we're going to continue to do a lot of work to expose, stigmatize that. And we know that when that is exposed, people get angry. And when they get angry, they tell their politicians, they tell their representatives, and hopefully we can change the mind. So that's just one piece that I think that's really important to keep in mind as well when we're thinking about how to address these issues.
That's dirtyenergymoney.com.
That's right.
David Turnbull of Oil Change International, thanks for a conversation about how to give us the energy we need without trashing the planet.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Every Tuesday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, KBOO brings you the Anjali and the Kid Show with DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid. Post-national bass, folk, and urban sounds that'll knock you upside the head.
It's Anjali and the Kid every Tuesday night on KBOO.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the 24th annual Cascades Festival of African Films, which will be held from January 31st through March 1st at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus and the Hollywood Theater. The 24th season will open with Gree Gree, a drama set in Chad, following a young man who, despite suffering from partial paralysis, becomes a renowned dancer at the local nightclub. The film will show on January 31st at 6:30 and 9 at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. Over 20 films will be screened in this year's 24th annual Cascade African Film Festival, beginning on January 31st, running through March 1st. For more information, please go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Thank you.
This is KBOO-FM. You're listening to Out Loud, KBOO's queer news. Thank you. KBOO Portland, and this is Out Loud, KBOO's queer news and culture radio program. Thanks for tuning in. This is KBOO. Thanks for tuning in. We are here on Out Loud Tuesday evenings, 6 p.m. Thanks for joining us. I'm Alan, your host tonight. We have a couple of organizers with the LGBTQ Meaningful Care Conference here tonight. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tell us who you are. Let's start there.
Hi, I'm Dana Morrison. I'm the coordinator of the LGBTQ Health Coalition of the Columbia Willamette, and we are hosting the 2014 Meaningful Care Conference on March 28th, 2014. The community to be aware of kind of what we're doing and getting your providers and yourself to attend and kind of make sure that health disparities in Oregon are reduced.
And I'm Angela Carter. I am the Education Committee Chair for the Meaningful Care Conference, and I'm also a naturopathic physician and midwife in Northeast Portland.
Exciting. Thanks so much for being here. You know, I've been looking over some of the data you sent me and the possible presentations and past presentations,